Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the June 2nd, 2023 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week has Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in his typical dark blue suit. In his right hand, he's holding behind his back, kind of hiding it. It looks like a riding crop or maybe a training whip. In his left hand, he has a bouquet of flowers. He's got it extended in his arm to the Republican elephant, but the Republican elephant is looking away from him, kind of scowling. He's wearing a Make America Great Again hat, and he's got a banner draped across his back that says, Trump 2024. The headline is, Wooing the GOP. Can DeSantis win the hearts of voters who still love Trump? We'll get that story on the controversy of the week, but we'll start with one of the main stories. Ukraine may finally get F-16 fighter jets. What happened? Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky got a promise of F-16 fighter jets, and much of what he asked for in a surprise visit to the Group of Seven summit, which concluded this week in Hiroshima, Japan. After refusing for more than a year to supply Kyiv with U.S.-made fighter jets, President Biden reversed course and agreed to allow allies to send their surplus F-16s. But while at least five European countries have said they might be able to provide F-16s or help train Ukrainian pilots, no country has yet committed a single jet, and deployment and training will take months. In the meantime, the G7, a group including the U.S., U.K., Italy, France, Germany, Canada, and Japan, plus the EU, also pledged nearly $20 billion in additional aid to Ukraine. Zelensky said the images he saw in Hiroshima museums of the city's devastation by a U.S. nuclear bomb in World War II reminded him of Bakhmut, Ukraine, which fell to Russian troops in recent days. Hiroshima is a rebuilt city, he said, and we dream of rebuilding all our cities that are now in ruins. At least 20,000 Russians died in the months-long battle for Bakhmut, most of them mercenaries from Russia's Wagner group. Its leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, said in a stunning interview with a pro-war blogger this week, that Russia's war had backfired spectacularly by creating a more militarized and pro-Western Ukraine. He blasted the Russian army for failing to fight well even on its own territory, a reference to a cross-border attack this week in which ethnic Russian militias fighting for Ukraine assaulted the Russian region of Belgorod, saying that Russian elites' disconnect from the ordinary Russians could lead to a revolution against the Kremlin. Complete with pitchforks. He called on President Vladimir Putin to impose martial law and call up more recruits. What the editorial said, Ukraine's success against the odds continues, said the Guardian. While it lost Bakhmut this week, that city holds little strategic value for either side. Now the startling cross-border attacks on Belgorod have already shifted attention from Russian military success to Russian military humiliation. Kyiv has repeatedly shown itself to be defter and more energetic than its adversary. Still, a long and punishing conflict lies ahead. At last, Ukraine will be getting F-16, said the Wall Street Journal. Now imagine what the war might look like today if the Biden administration hadn't dragged its feet for so long. NATO countries are flush with F-16s, with 2,200 deployed worldwide, and they easily could have sent some to Ukraine a year ago. Biden's fretting about provoking Russia has led him to a maddening and misguided pattern. Resist more advanced weapons, then finally provide them much later after more carnage. It's exactly the same thing he did with the Patriot anti-missile systems. What the columnist said, greenlighting the F-16s required complicated risk-benefit calculations, said retired Admiral James Stavridis, former commander of NATO in Bloomberg. The Swiss Army knife of the air, it can fire air-to-air missiles and is relatively simple for experienced pilots to operate. It also requires 16 hours of maintenance for every hour of flight, though, which could consume too much of Ukraine's valuable combat resources and personnel. But if used intelligently, the F-16's benefits will be significant, letting Ukraine attack occupied territory from the safety of its airspace. Zelensky scored a diplomatic triumph at Hiroshima, rallying G7 leaders behind him, said Gideon Rockman in the Financial Times. But the brutal realities on the ground will test their resolve. Ukraine now has enough weaponry to mount a serious offensive, but still faces the great known unknown of whether it can successfully find and exploit weaknesses in Russia's front lines. Western countries, meanwhile, have all but emptied their inventories of relevant munitions. Continued deadlock could erode foreign support. Recent polls show U.S. approval for arming Ukraine slipping to 50% from about 60% last year. Americans may be weary of military entanglements, said David French in the New York Times, but this is the most strategically important military conflict in generations, and we're not the ones bleeding and dying. Ukrainian valor is breathtaking, as I saw on a recent trip to Kyiv. The combination of their courage and U.S. weaponry is already proving decisive. Now is not the time to falter. Now is the time to send those jets. And the controversy of the week. DeSantis, can he woo Republicans away from Trump? Ron DeSantis finally launched his presidential campaign this week, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. But unless he evolves, it could be brief. Establishment Republicans still have high hopes for the culture-warring Florida governor, seeing in him a youthful can-do conservative who models Donald Trump's pugnacity without the mountain of baggage. Polls of Republicans continue to show DeSantis has the best chance in a growing field of beating Trump for the nomination, but those same polls show DeSantis' prospects rapidly heading in the wrong direction. Despite his strenuous efforts to brand himself the anti-woke candidate, he now trails Trump in the Real Clear Politics aggregate poll by a daunting 37 points, up from just 13 points in February. There's no single reason why DeSantis has hemorrhaged momentum, said Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast. It didn't help that he called Russia's invasion of Ukraine a territorial dispute and then walked that back. His ill-advised petty vendetta against Disney has resulted in death by a thousand Mickey Mouse-shaped cuts. And then there's the charisma-free candidate himself, whose first public events in Iowa and New Hampshire have confirmed reports that he's an aloof and awkward individual who simply is not good at personal interactions with voters. It's early, of course, and Trump's legal woes could still catch up with him, but DeSantis may have already blown his narrow chance of ousting Trump. DeSantis still has a solid chance, said Harry Enten in CNN.com. His national poll numbers have slumped in the low 20s, But at this stage in 2008, that's where both eventual nominees, Barack Obama and John McCain, were polling too. If DeSantis can win primaries in Iowa or New Hampshire, it could jumpstart his campaign. DeSantis' strongest argument is that he has a better chance of beating Joe Biden, said Noah Rothman in National Review. In 5 of 6 crucial swing states, DeSantis fares better than Trump in a theoretical matchup with Biden. If Republican voters want to win in 2024 and break what DeSantis calls the GOP's recent culture of losing, his electability argument could be pivotal. Don't bet on it, said Ramesh Ponuru in the Washington Post. Republican voters were told back in 2015 that Trump couldn't win. His victory the next year convinced them that the concept of electability is a ploy used by the media and squishy Republicans to discredit candidates who are willing to fight for them. Most of these voters falsely think Trump actually won in 2020, and it would be heresy for DeSantis to state otherwise. Electability is a cowardly euphemism anyway, said Gerard Baker in the Wall Street Journal. If DeSantis wants to be the party's leader, he has to plainly and emphatically state the obvious, that Trump has proved himself unfit to be president. That would likely backfire, said Rich Lowry in the New York Times. Calling Trump unhinged would trigger a defensive reaction from Republicans who voted for him. The sweet spot is for DeSantis to cite Trump's losing record in 2018, 2020, and 2022 while emphasizing his own hard edge on cultural issues. In the end, it may be that Republicans decide that they still want to show that only Trump can, the show that only Trump can provide. But with roughly half the GOP wary of nominating Trump again, DeSantis is not dead yet. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for freak flags after blues musician Otis Taylor, 74, of Denver, finally received the high school diploma he was denied in 1966 because school officials insisted he cut his bushy afro. Taylor said he used to wear fringed leather jackets and beaded moccasins in addition to his long hair, so I always sort of stood out. It was a good week for resilience after Florida man Jordan Rivera went out to pee outside a bar, fell into a pond, and had his arm bitten off by an alligator. I lost an arm. It's not the end of the world, Rivera said. And it was a good week for true love, with reports that Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, the world's third richest person, gave a 30-carat engagement ring to his girlfriend, Lauren Sanchez. The smitten Bezos also put Sanchez's face on the buxom wooden figurehead of his $500 million mega yacht. But it was also a bad week for true love after far-right Colorado Representative Lauren Boebert, who once advised women that all marital difficulties could be solved by the power that you have in Christ, announced that she is divorcing Jason, the father of her 4 children. It was a bad week for sheep, which are gradually losing their numerical advantage over the human population of New Zealand. New data show that sheep now outnumber people by 25.3 million to 5.2 million, a far cry from the 22 to 1 ratio in 1982. Finally, it was a bad week for diplomacy. After Senator John Kennedy, the Republican from Louisiana, said at a hearing that without the people of America, the people of Mexico would be eating cat food out of a can and living in a tent. Mexico's U.S. Ambassador Esteban Moctezuma called Kennedy's comment low, uninformed, and arrogant. This week's briefing is titled, Censoring Ideas and Rewriting History. Several states are banning books and criminalizing the teaching of controversial topics. What's become verboten? Is censorship growing? Yes, recently passed state and local legislation is dictating what schools may or may not teach and what students may or may not read. A record 2,571 different titles were banned or censored by school districts, states, and other government entities in 2022, according to the American Library Association, a 38% increase from the previous year. Nearly 60% of those bans were aimed at classrooms and school libraries, and most of the targeted books were by or about racial minorities or LGBTQ people. Broad, vaguely defined prohibitions on teaching critical race theory and other allegedly divisive topics in classrooms have compelled 1 in 4 U.S. teachers to alter their curricula. In Florida, a textbook publisher even had to completely remove a purely factual passage on George Floyd's murder and the subsequent Black Lives Matter protest. In at least a half dozen states, teachers and school librarians are now face potential prison time for violating the bans. It isn't just individual books being removed, restricted, suppressed in public schools anymore, said Casey Meehan of the Pen America Foundation. It's a set of ideas, its themes, its identities, its knowledge on the history of our country. Where is this happening? Most of the restrictions enacted this school year have been passed by Republican-controlled legislatures in Texas, Florida, Missouri, Utah, and South Carolina. Spurred by conservative groups such as Moms for Liberty, a 2-year-old organization that has helped propel hundreds of like-minded candidates onto school boards, these legislatures have passed laws with broad restrictions on topics they deem inappropriate. The mere presence of LGBTQ people in a book can be enough to merit the label obscene. In Florida and several other states, all books must be screened by official censors before they are deemed acceptable, with wholesale bans on references to sex, race, and gender identity, regardless of context. In Missouri, a new law banning books containing explicit sexual material led school districts to junk art history textbooks and nonfiction accounts of the Holocaust. In Texas, which had more book bannings than any other state last year, a bill currently under consideration would ban textbooks that portray U.S. history in anything but a positive light. In Florida, new laws pushed by Governor Ron DeSantis have tied educators in knots and emptied some school library shelves. What do Florida's laws say? One law requires every book in a school's possession to be posted on an online database and vetted by media specialists to ensure it's free of pornography. State guidelines urge schools to err on the side of caution on what they approve. In 2 large school districts, which contain the cities of Bradenton and Jacksonville, administrators ordered the removal or concealment of tens of thousands of books in their schools. Students returned from their winter break to find bookshelves empty or covered with paper. Florida's paternal rights and education law bans discussions of sexual orientation or gender identity from kindergarten to 3rd grade, while its Stop Woke Act outlaws books that could lead any student to feel race or sex-related guilt, anguish, or other forms of psychological distress. How have teachers responded? Many Florida teachers are scared to death to tell students anything about America's racial history, said Charles White, executive director of the Social Science Education Consortium. To pass muster, one textbook publisher even eliminated any mention of race in telling the story of Rosa Parks refusing to change her seat on a public bus. DeSantis insists it's a nasty hoax that state laws require broad book bans, and that he is simply fighting woke leftists who are trying to pollute and sexualize our children. What is the impact of these laws? They've made teachers paranoid and deeply fearful about losing their licenses and being charged with crimes. In some states, tip lines now exist for reporting teachers who discuss inappropriate topics. Arizona now requires parental approval before teachers can include books containing any reference to sex. Some educators, such as Stuart, Florida middle school science teacher Ariane Dineen, say the rules are forcing teachers to consider leaving the profession. "It feels like you can be reported by anyone at any time," she said. "It feels very much like 1984 or the McCarthy era." Do most parents support this? No. A Fox News poll released in April revealed that 77% of parents were extremely or very worried about book bans. Other polls found that about 80% of both Republicans and Democrats say books should never be banned for discussing race, slavery, or critical views of U.S. history. Democratic pollster Guy Molyneux said a majority of parents say they are uncomfortable with some of this gender transitional treatment kids are getting. "And I don't know how I feel about pronouns, but I do not want them banning books." Time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. First up, covering up Feinstein's dementia. "Dianne Feinstein is setting a precedent that's bad for the Republic," said Tiana Lowe. The 89-year-old Democratic senator from California recently returned to the Capitol after about 3 months away due to shingles, reappearing wheelchair-bound and with a partially paralyzed face. Her staff did not previously reveal that Feinstein's shingles had led to encephalitis, a serious complication that causes brain swelling and can result in lasting memory and language problems. Feinstein has been visibly confused, even telling a reporter that she'd been working at the Capitol the whole time. For years, Rolling Stone revealed, Feinstein staffers have had a system to keep her from ever walking around the Capitol on her own, out of concerns about her increasing senility. Now they've tightened their usual iron ring of security. Still, she refuses calls from within her own party to resign, a breathtakingly selfish move that deprives her millions of constituents of competent representation. Sadly, in the gerontocracy of Congress, it's unlikely that Feinstein is the only fossil being propped up by staff. How many other aging public officials are beginning to cross the threshold between merely occasional forgetfulness and being a national security risk? The wildfire toxins in your lungs. "Americans often think of wildfires as a California problem," said Davis Wallace Wells. "But new research is showing how far their toxic smoke spreads and how widely its noxious impacts are distributed. Sometimes the smoke is visible, like the soot-filled winds that drifted down to Colorado last week from massive blazes burning 1,500 miles away in Alberta, Canada. More often, people inhale particulate pollution from distant wildfires without knowing it. A new Stanford study found that about 60% of the smoke impact of American wildfires is experienced by those living outside the states where the trees are in flames. Because of the jet stream, fires in the West actually cause more health damage to people living east of the Rockies. The airborne particulates created in wildfires have been shown by research to raise your risk of lung cancer, brain tumors, respiratory and cardiac disease, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, cognitive performance and memory issues, and miscarriage. The damage is growing worse as climate change makes wildfires fiercer and far more frequent. Six of the biggest seven California wildfires have occurred since 2020. In coming decades, wildfires will be the dominant source of particulate pollution in the U.S. This column comes from South Africa. U.S. Christians are driving anti-gay laws. Africa is not the anti-gay monolith the Western media makes it out to be, said Pierre DeVos. True, Uganda adopted a draconian bill criminalizing homosexuality earlier this month, and Kenya is considering one. But the story is much more complicated than that. Last week, Namibia's Supreme Court said the state must recognize the validity of same-sex marriages for Namibian citizens who wed abroad, and its ruling suggested it would expand gay rights further. Nor is Namibia alone. Over the past decade, many African countries, including Angola, Botswana, and Mozambique, repealed their colonial-era laws that had criminalized same-sex acts. The countries going the other way, such as Uganda and Kenya, are the countries explicitly targeted by the American far-right Christian group Family International. Its president, Sharon Slater, was actively involved in campaigning and strategizing for the Uganda law, even meeting with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni in April. Family International has also been busy lobbying African countries to curtail abortion, birth control, and even sex education. The truth is, there is no homegrown trend toward intensified oppression of queer people. There's only a Western one imposed from the outside. The last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, When Choice is Gone. New abortion bans are tying doctors' hands and forcing women to continue troubled pregnancies at the risk of their own lives, said journalist Kavitha Surana in ProPublica. This is one woman's story. One day late last summer, Dr. Barry Grimm called a fellow obstetrician at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Tennessee to consult about a patient who was 10 weeks pregnant. Her embryo had become implanted in scar tissue from a recent cesarean section, and she was in serious danger. At any moment, the pregnancy could rip open her uterus. Dr. Matt Goldberg, who was trained in abortion care for life-threatening pregnancy complications, pulled up the patient's charts. He did not like the look of them. The muscle separating her pregnancy from her bladder was as thin as tissue paper. Her placenta threatened to eventually invade her organs like a tumor. Even with the best medical care in the world, some patients bleed out in less than 10 minutes on the operating table. Goldberg had seen it happen. Maren Michelle Hollis stood to lose her bladder, her uterus, and her life. She was desperate to end the pregnancy. On the phone, the two doctors agreed this was the best path forward, guided by recommendations from the Society for Maternal-Fetal Medicine, an association of 5,500 experts on high-risk pregnancy. The longer they waited, the more complicated the procedure would be. Vanderbilt declined to comment for this article, but Hollis' doctors spoke to ProPublica in their personal capacity, with her permission, risking backlash in order to give the public a rare view into the dangers created when lawmakers interfere with high-stakes medical care. Goldberg spent the next 2 days trying to rally support from his colleagues for a procedure that would previously have been routine. First, Goldberg and a colleague tried the interventional radiology department. To lower Hollis's chance of bleeding, Goldberg wanted doctors to insert a special gel into the artery that supplied blood to her uterus to reduce its flow. But that department's leadership didn't feel comfortable participating. Next, they approached a maternal-fetal medicine specialist who a week earlier had said he would be able to provide an injection to stop the fetus from growing and decrease blood flow. But once the law went into effect, that specialist grew uneasy. He would have to do the same procedure in a room of nurses and scrub techs with an ultrasound image projected on the wall, all potential evidence that could be used against him in a trial. He thought about his family, what it would mean to go to prison. "I'm so disappointed in myself," he told Goldberg and his colleague as he refused to participate. Goldberg felt sick when he told Grimm his decision. "It's too dangerous," he said. Grimm felt a mix of anger, fear, and sadness burning beneath his ribs. He could scarcely believe the situation. Raised Christian in the Deep South, he had never agreed with abortion as a moral choice. But as an OBGYN whose patient was in mortal peril, he couldn't begin to comprehend what politicians were thinking. He had told Hollis an abortion ban was coming, but had thought there would be an exception for cases like hers that came with high risks. He collected himself as he dialed Hollis. It was August 26, the day after the ban went into effect. It was also Hollis's 32nd birthday. She was at her job as an insulator apprentice, monitoring her coworkers as they wrapped rolls of fiberglass around pipes, when she saw Grimm's name flash on her phone. She headed outside, her long hair coiled under a hard hat, her stomach churning. The past month had been a dizzying, sickening whirlwind of thrill, then worry, then stubborn hope, then all-consuming terror. She didn't want to lose her pregnancy, but she didn't want to die. Now, as she stepped outside to take the call, all she wanted to hear was her doctor's usual calm reassurance and the plan for her care. But Grimm's voice was heavy as he began. "I'm so, so sorry." Raised in the depths of Tennessee's opioid epidemic in a family haunted by addiction, Hollis' earliest memory is of clutching her baby brother when she was 5 years old, as her alcoholic father flipped tables. When she was 9, she said, her mother's boyfriend gave her drugs and read her the Bible before he molested her. By 12, she was living with a teenage boyfriend and babysitting his brothers in exchange for hydrocodone pills. At 21, Hollis began having children, first a son and then 2 daughters. At 27, when she had her 3rd child, she was trying to stay sober. But the father of that child, Chris Hollis, showed up to the hospital high on opioids. The Department of Children's Services drug tested him and took custody of all Hollis's children. When Grimm met her in 2021 at a clinic for mothers with opioid use disorder, she was pregnant with her 4th child and sober. After baby Zoe arrived in February 2022, it seemed to Hollis like life was finally gathering momentum. She had reconnected with Chris, now both in recovery. They had gotten married, rented a house in Clarksville, a small town near a military base, and joined a church. Together, they ran a small vinyl siding business. Hollis managed the accounting and worked a factory job for extra income. She hoped to save enough to buy a house and eventually pay lawyers to get her other children back. Then, in July, Hollis was shocked to learn she was pregnant again. She had just begun taking birth control pills, but it might have been too recent for them to be effective. Her first call was to Grimm, who worried that a pregnancy this soon, on top of 4 previous C-sections, put her at risk of developing a cesarean scar ectopic pregnancy. By Hollis' 8-week ultrasound in early August, Grimm's worst fears were confirmed. Her life was at risk, he told her. Her pregnancy could rupture and cause a hemorrhage the first trimester. It was almost certain to eventually develop into a life-threatening placenta disorder. There was little data to predict whether the baby would make it. If it survived, it was sure to be born extremely early, spend months in critical care, and face developmental challenges. He offered to schedule an abortion for 2 days later. If they moved quickly, the procedure would be relatively straightforward, but Hollis needed time to think. On August 24th, about 2 weeks after learning the diagnosis, she messaged the doctor. Dr. Grimm, me and my husband need to talk to you. We have really thought about everything, and we need you to call us. But 2 days later, Hollis paced outside her workplace, listening to Grimm break the news that the other doctors had backed out due to the current legal climate. The only thought Hollis could muster was no. No, 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 no. This could not be happening. Not now. At regular appointments, Grimm watched in horror as Hollis' placenta began to bulge and threaten her bladder, an expected consequence of a cesarean ectopic pregnancy. She was exhibiting all the signs of developing placenta prekrita, the worst form of placenta disorder, a condition that makes high-risk specialists shudder. Delivery requires massive blood transfusions, often necessitates removal of the bladder, and carries a 7% chance of death. Grimm didn't know what to do for Hollis. Her texts came at all hours about her problems sleeping, her concerns about paying rent, her worries about the baby's movement, and the pain she felt. She had not been at her company long enough to qualify for disability leave and begged him to help her appeal. I'm not sure what else I can do. I'm running out of time, and I'm scared. In the end, he couldn't offer much more than directing her to social workers and sharing earnest platitudes. You're the bravest person I know, he told her. On December 8th, Hollis started bleeding. She was nearly 26 weeks pregnant. She had insisted on driving herself to Vanderbilt, an hour away from her home. Her husband joined her in the passenger seat and panicked when she started to pass out. They called 911, and an ambulance drove her the rest of the way. Dr. Sarah Osmondson, a maternal-fetal medicine specialist, was on call that day. She worked exclusively with the most difficult pregnancies. Over the years, she said, she had seen some women choose to accept the risks of a dangerous diagnosis and die as a result. But since the law went into effect, patients were arriving at her office asking why they were being counseled at all. It doesn't matter, they told her. I don't have a choice. Osmondson gave Hollis her phone number, and the hospital released her after 3 days, planning for her to return in 2 weeks when her pregnancy had reached 7 months. But less than 2 days later, in the early morning hours of December 13th, Hollis' husband woke, Chris, woke to screaming. He ran to her and slipped in blood, which was pooling on the ground. Hollis had bled through her pants, soaking her socks and the rug by the front door. She and Chris texted photos to Osmondson, who became convinced an emergency cesarean needed to happen as soon as possible. As soon as Grimm's phone rang, he was wide awake. He lay in bed in the dark, calling the hospital and refreshing his phone for updates. At any moment, he knew Hollis could bleed to death. Chris called an ambulance, and they took her to a local hospital to be stabilized and airlifted. But bad weather meant the helicopter couldn't fly. Finally, 2 hours later, they returned to the ambulance, which drove her to Vanderbilt. Hollis was relieved to see Grimm waiting in his scrubs. He held her hand as they wheeled her into the operating room, which was filled with a surgery team of nearly 20 doctors. To Hollis, the doctors around her looked as scared as she was. The anesthesiologist told Hollis to count backward from 10, but instead she prayed. Once Hollis was under, Grimm helped make the incision. Typically, patients emerge from a C-section with a small horizontal cut below their bikini line. But this delivery called for a vertical gash that stretched up past her navel. Careful not to disrupt the placenta, which was attached to the bladder and ballooning outward, Grimm gently removed a baby girl. She emerged weighing 1 pound and 15 ounces, limp and unable to breathe on her own. Doctors dried and intubated her, wrapped her, and placed her under a radiant warmer to try to keep her organs from shutting down. No one knew if she would survive. Then Dr. Marta Crispins, a gynecological oncologist trained to deal with big tumors, began to work on removing the uterus. The placenta started gushing blood again. This is what made the condition so frightening. There was no predicting the level of bleeding and whether it could be contained in time. The intensity in the room ratcheted up. It seemed to Grimm like hours passed as he helped Crispin stanch the bleeding. Finally, the operation ended. Hollis and her daughter had made it through alive. As the doctors cleaned up, there were the usual backpats and shared congratulations between a team that had united to make it through a life-saving surgery. But they could all recall similar cases where things didn't end as well. "I'm glad she's okay," Odmundson recalled saying in the moment. "But it's a tragedy that this happened. This is not a win." Crispins felt everyone in the room was traumatized. "This is going to drive people out of the medical profession," she thought. "We took an oath. We have to be able to take care of these women before they get to this point." Grimm left the room, peeled off his scrubs, and wept. When Hollis awoke from surgery, he was holding her hand. On February 23rd, the hospital told Hollis she could take her daughter home. Elena weighed 4 pounds and 12 ounces, still the size of one of Zoe's dolls. But about a week later, Elena began showing signs of respiratory distress. One night, she suddenly stopped breathing. Hollis performed CPR until police officers arrived and saved Elena's life. Two ambulance rides later, Elena was airlifted to Vanderbilt. Over the following days, doctors outfitted her with a breathing machine. They told Hollis it was possible Elena could have a bacterial infection, such as meningitis, in the fluid around her brain. To find out, they would need to do a spinal tap. Hollis stayed as long as she could, but too much was waiting for her back home, and she hated seeing her baby suffering. She whispered a quiet blessing and left Elena in the pediatric intensive care unit, cocooned under the glow of a warming lamp. This was adapted from a story that first published by ProPublica. Here's one of the obituaries this week. The NFL legend and actor with a complex legacy, Jim Brown, 1936 to 2023. Jim Brown was an unstoppable force in the NFL. Voted the greatest football player of the 20th century by an Associated Press panel in 1999. The chiseled 6'2", 230-pound fullback never missed a game with the Cleveland Browns from 1957 to 1965. He led the league in rushing 8 of his 9 seasons, bursting by or barreling over defenders. His on-field heroics powered the Browns to the 1964 NFL championship and earned him 3 Most Valuable Player awards, while off the field, Hollywood wanted him as an action hero. He was in London filming The Dirty Dozen when the Browns owner said he'd be fined for each day he missed training camp. Brown responded by abruptly retiring from football at age 30, stunning the team and its fans. Brown, one of the era's most outspoken black athletes, wasn't content being an over-glamorized gladiator, he said. Anyone who expected me to be overjoyed that I was doing well in football would be disappointed. Brown was born on St. Simon's Island, Georgia, and a few weeks later his father abandoned the family, said the New York Times. He grew up in Long Island, New York, where his mother had relocated, and became a multi-sport standout, excelling in football and lacrosse at Syracuse University. He went on to set 15 NFL records, and his impact as a social activist was also profound, said USA Today. In 1967, Brown joined several of the era's top black athletes in defending Muhammad Ali's refusal to fight in Vietnam. He performed in Hollywood's first big interracial love scene, opposite Raquel Welch, in 1969's 100 Rifles, and went on to feature in dozens of other films. Brown's commitment to activism was lifelong. He supported black-owned businesses and helped former gang members change through the AmeriCan program, said the Washington Post. But his private life was tumultuous. He was arrested at least seven times for assault, usually against women, including for allegedly throwing a girlfriend off a second-story balcony in 1968. Brown was never convicted of a major crime. In each case, he was either exonerated by the jury or his accusers refused to press charges. I'm not interested in trying to work on people's perceptions, he once said. I am who I am, and if you don't take the time to learn about that, then your perception is going to be your problem. Here's one of the health and science pieces. A genome for all humans. When the human genome was deciphered more than 20 years ago, the DNA that was sequenced came almost entirely from one person, a mixed-race man from Buffalo. Now, drawing DNA from a wide variety of people, more than 120 scientists have dramatically expanded that outline and created a pangenome that should lead to vast improvements in personalized medicine. The pangenome incorporates near-complete sequences from 47 people of diverse backgrounds, including West Africans, South Americans, and East Asians. If the human genome is like a single road, reports the Washington Post, the pangenome is more like a subway map, with most routes clustered together in the middle but diverging at the ends. This broader genetic guide is already revealing significant variations in human genetic expression. It should help researchers identify variations associated with medical conditions, such as heart disease, schizophrenia, and rare cancers, and deliver treatments that benefit all patients, whatever their race or ancestry. The pangenome is, of course, still a work in progress, as 47 people can't represent all of humanity. In the next 2 years, another 350 genetic blueprints will be added. We can see human variation as if through a new microscope, said geneticist Evan Eichler of the University of Washington, one of the project's authors. We'll now be able to make new associations to predict diseases and disease outcomes. And over on the Talking Points page, we have an article, Trump and Russia. It was no hoax. Bombshell, screamed the conservative website, The Federalist. The crime of the century, trumpeted Republican Representative Jim Jordan. Who should go to jail for this, demanded GOP Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. They were among the many allies of Donald Trump who pretended that a new report on the FBI investigation into the Trump campaign's ties to Russia was Watergate times 10 or 100, said Jonathan Weissman in the New York Times. The explosive reaction stood in striking contrast to the actual report, the result of a four-year investigation by Special Counsel John Durham, who in 2019 was tasked by then-Attorney General William Barr with probing possible malfeasance in the Justice Department's Russia investigation. Durham's inquisition produced no startling revelations and yielded only two acquittals and a guilty plea on minor charges. His final report quibbled with FBI decisions, but found no evidence of a deep state conspiracy or Trump's innocence. Republicans' emphatic insistence that Durham did find a massive scandal exonerating Trump is Exhibit A in how the American right seems to be living in its own universe and how Trump still dictates the parameters of that separate reality. Durham's report may have been a dud, said David Korn in Mother Jones, but he accomplished a key goal for Trump and his lapdog loyalists. For 7 years, they've conducted a crusade of distraction designed to divert attention from a fundamental reality. Russia waged a concerted, multi-pronged effort in 2016 to damage Hillary Clinton with hacked Democratic emails, used social media campaigns to discourage Bernie Sanders' progressives and black people from voting, and helped install Trump in the White House. Trump and his aides aided and abetted that assault by denying it was happening and by signaling to Moscow they welcomed its effort to undermine American democracy. The evidence runs deep, said Glenn Kessler in the Washington Post. Both the 2019 report by Special Counsel Robert Mueller and a 2020 report by the bipartisan Senate Intelligence Committee concluded that Russia tried to swing the 2016 election to Trump and that Trump's campaign welcomed the interference of a hostile foreign power. Among their findings, Russian President Vladimir Putin personally ordered the hacking of Democratic National Committee servers and subsequently published stolen emails via WikiLeaks. When Trump publicly gloated over the WikiLeaks release, he invited Putin's hackers, Russia, if you're listening, to attack Clinton's personal email server. Hours later, Russian hackers did just that, although they failed to get in. Trump advisor Roger Stone was in direct communication with WikiLeaks, while campaign manager Paul Manafort maintained frequent contact with Russian intelligence officer Konstantin Kalimnik and gave Russia polling data on battleground states. Both Stone and Manafort lied repeatedly about their contacts with Russians and were convicted, imprisoned, and subsequently pardoned by Trump, who publicly dangled pardons to them if they didn't flip. It was a highly successful cover-up. In all, Mueller documented more than 140 contacts between Trump and his associates and Russian nationals, said Paul Waldman, also in the Washington Post. The Trump-Russia alliance was anything but a hoax. Still, Durham found some troubling misconduct by the FBI, said Declan Garvey in the Dispatch. He documented numerous instances of unprofessional, incompetent, and prejudiced conduct by FBI agents, whom Durham concluded were too quick to believe the questionable material supplied by Clinton partisans, including the infamous Steele dossier. Durham's conclusion that investigators displayed partisan hostility to Trump sounds about right, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. But that still does not explain away Trump's shocking behavior at the most famous Trump-Putin joint news conference in Helsinki in 2018. It was clear by then that Russia had interfered in the 2016 election, but standing next to a smirking Putin, a fawning, subservient Trump dismissed the findings of his own intelligence agencies and voiced his trust in his pal Vladimir. It was chilling, and it was shameful. What was that strange thing between Trump and Putin? Republicans don't want to know, said David Frum in The Atlantic. The Trump allies howling about FBI procedural infractions are mounting a classic Miranda rights criminal defense. A procedural error by the cops means a crook who mugged an old lady must go free. In his misleading report, Durham changes the subject to something much less uncomfortable than the evidence that the Trump presidency was compromised by a corrupt foreign dictatorship. Trump, who's seeking a return to the White House in 2024, still has nothing but flattering words for Putin, no matter what atrocities the tyrant commits. Some of the less anesthetized Republicans are bound to wonder why. And with just about a minute left, we'll take a short note or two. The weight of New York City buildings, an estimated 1.8 trillion pounds, is making the city's underlying ground sink as much as 0.08 of an inch each year on average, a new study found. Meanwhile, the waters surrounding the city's five boroughs have risen about 9 inches since 1950. More than 1,000 incidents involving firearms have occurred in U.S. schools since 2018. Last year alone, there were 303 gun-related incidents on school grounds in which 273 people were killed or wounded. And we will finish out today's show with a quote from Elijah Cummings, quoted in WYPR, who says, "Our children are the living messages we send to a future we will never see." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.